We turn now to the example of Pope St. Gregory the Great, whom we have already seen in the story of the interaction between Benedict and his sister Scholastica, taken from Gregory the Great's very important and beautiful book, The Dialogues, about which there is some scholarly controversy, but which I believe we can resolve in favor of Gregory's authorship of that volume. If we'll recall, that story is a reminder of the fact that Gregory lives in terrible times indeed. The West is quite literally falling to pieces. Imperial authority is no longer as present as it once was. There is a kind of seat of the Exarch in Ravenna, which represents a local connection, but in fact the West has more or less been required to fend for itself. It is subject to periodic raids from various barbarian tribes, and in fact a significant part of the West is under Arian barbarian overlordship. In many ways, it's a very devastated world. It must have been tragic to live in Gregory's era and see the great city of Rome literally collapsing around them. Many of the things that had been sources of pride were now sources of perplexity and embarrassment. The great artisans and what we would today call scientists, engineers, capable of maintaining the great buildings, monuments, even the sewer system, had long since fled, departed to Constantinople. Rome was now a backwater, and to be Bishop of Rome was no great, pleasant responsibility. On the contrary, it was an onerous burden, which is how Gregory experienced it. Nevertheless, he is one of the great popes of this era, and in fact sets the tone and the standard for the medieval papacy. We will look at three examples of texts from St. Gregory. We've mentioned in passing the Dialogues, which is his effort to create a theology of sanctity available even to the ordinary people and to transmit it by means of very accessible, even simplistic seeming stories. We will look this time at three texts which are quite different. His homily or his commentary on the Song of Songs, which represents his continuity with the earlier tradition and his desire to continue to transmit in the West a way of interpreting sacred text that is ultimately descended, as we've seen, from such figures as Origen and Clement of Alexandria, but adapted by Western authors and in particular by St. Ambrose. Gregory's commentary on the Song of Songs is a wonderful text, and it's also an introduction to an explanation of his own understanding of allegory. Gregory transmits spiritual doctrine by means of biblical exegesis to a very great extent. We aren't going to look in this context at his Moralia on Job, his allegorical exegesis of the book of Job, but we'll see in this commentary on the song his underlying theory of inspiration, or rather of interpretation, which allows him to write an extended spiritual commentary in which exegesis provides a means of communicating spiritual insight. After looking briefly at this text from the Song of Songs, we'll look at another great contribution of Gregory, his book, The Regula Pastoralis, The Pastoral Rule, or otherwise translated as On Pastoral Care, which was such an important text describing pastoral responsibilities, particularly those of a bishop, that it would ultimately be translated into Old English and made mandatory for all the bishops of Britain within a few centuries of Gregory's having written it. It is a wonderful text and introduction also to the art of spiritual direction, but we won't be able to follow that up to any great extent. And finally, we will look briefly at his commentaries on the Gospels, his homilies on the Gospels, which will provide us with an insight into a developing Eucharistic theology which we would today regard as somewhat problematic. Nevertheless, Gregory is one of the people who validates and transmits this understanding of the Eucharist to particularly the Western Church, and without it we cannot understand what will become the approach to Eucharistic theology and the understanding of the significance and value of the Mass in the Middle Ages. So we will look at these three things. If we look first at the commentary on the Song of Songs, we can recall that we've seen that in other great bishop catechists, there is a willingness to use the language of nuptial intimacy, even with the people of God, as a way of communicating to them God's sense of intimate longing for relationship with humankind. And the Song of Songs is the text par excellence that describes this. Gregory repeats this assertion in his own commentary, but also at the very beginning points out that this text is to be understood by means of allegory. And he defines allegory in chapter 2. It's a highlighted text that you can glance down at. Allegory functions as a device to lift the soul that is far from God to God. Allegory is a means of allowing one to find in the text a spiritual interpretation that literally lifts the soul up towards God. To create allegories, a little bit further on at the end of that same paragraph, the divine thoughts are cloaked with what we know. By examining exterior language, we attain an interior understanding. Here is his approach, which is that the surface of the text invites us into a deeper understanding, and he goes on to say in number 3, again highlighted, our heart is set on fire with yearning for that sacred love, the sacred love of God. He also repeats the injunctions that date back from the early church, that when interpreting this particular book of the Bible in a spiritual way, one must be careful about not lingering on or understanding it exclusively at a sensual or physical level. He says, we are instructed by the conversations proper to sensual love when their power causes us to enthusiastically burn with love for the divinity. And Gregory is regarded as one of the great spiritual authors of the late patristic, early medieval period. He communicates great spiritual doctrine primarily by his allegorical interpretations of the book of Job, his Moralia, and also his homilies on the prophetic texts, and in particular his homilies on the texts of Ezekiel. He is source of much later medieval commentary, his commentaries using this approach of allegory that we've just seen described here become standard textbook material for the later Middle Ages. As does, if we drop down a little further, his wonderful work on pastoral care. We won't be looking at the portions of this text where he invites the person with responsibility for the soul of another who is responsible for teaching or for correcting or for explicating sacred text to be very much aware of the different kinds of people to whom he will be speaking. That's a very important part much later on in the pastoral care, where he lists all the different what we might call temperament or psychological types that one must try to reach and how one must try to adapt oneself to those different types. But we look here at the introduction to his book of pastoral rule, to his book on pastoral care, and he begins by pointing out that he is accused, quite rightly, of having at one point in the past wished to hide himself, to fly from the burdens of pastoral care. He repeats this again in the introduction to the dialogues and also in the Moralia. He reminds people that he never wanted to be Bishop of Rome, he never wanted to be Pope, that this burden was thrust upon him and he accepted it unwillingly. But having come to it, he now feels obliged to help others who have been given this responsibility to discharge it properly, to discharge it in a way that is worthy of this responsibility in Christ. And so if you drop down a little bit to the section that I've divided up into separate numbered segments, he says the book is divided into 4 separate heads of argument. First, in what way a person should come to high leadership? How do we find ourselves in this position? How do we receive it or accept it? Having attained it, how should we live? Life should match responsibility. A person in authority must live the life they preach and teach to others. And then living well, how you should teach, what should be our approach in teaching. And I've already mentioned that part of this is that we must accommodate our teaching to the unique characteristics of each of those to whom we are speaking. And he says we should daily become aware of our own infirmities. There's an ongoing process of formation and reformation, which is an essential part of spiritual leadership. So these would be the sections of the book, and here he contrasts them with, or suggests that one has to be careful about, humility keep one from accepting this responsibility, or one's life somehow not be lived in accordance with what one is going to have to teach. So false humility should not keep one from accepting authority, But one should not be living a life that is anything other than what one is going to attempt to teach others. Nor should one be comfortable, he says in number three, about a life lived but without teaching. If you're going to have authority in the church, you must be willing to speak. It is not sufficient simply to live a life of holiness if you are a pastor, if you are one to whom this book of pastoral rule, this book of pastoral care is devoted. Preaching, using the word, is essential. Teaching cannot, he says, be absent from this life. Nor should presumption, vainglory, pride, unduly exalt the teaching. So, therefore, he says, as a kind of a little hint, and you can get a sense of his method, therefore, fear should temper our desire. We should have awe before this responsibility that we take on. And afterwards, authority being assumed, the life should commend it. He comes to this theme over and over again. Your life must be lived in such a way that you are actually doing what you teach. So the good which is displayed in the life of the pastor should be propagated by speech. You must be willing to preach. And you must be more and more aware of your own infirmity, aware of one's own need to change. So an ongoing process of asceticism and of a spiritual transformation must be a part of one's lifestyle. So this is a kind of a useful introduction to, and it gives us a hint or a foretaste of this very significant, much loved, frequently read text that provided a standard for how one should be a pastoral leader. And one might add parenthetically that this is one of the great applications of monastic theology to the context of the preaching and teaching in the context of episcopal authority. Gregory is a monk. Gregory lived as a monk in a monastery he founded on property his family owned on the Salian Hill in Rome, and it's monastic spirituality that he is bringing, adapting, and applying to the context of the pastoral ministry, and it represents one of the great gifts, this sensitivity to the souls of others, this sense of the necessity for teaching, all of which one can see is very much standing behind the role of the abbot in a cenobitic community. Now we drop down to the last section, which is perhaps less tasteful in some ways, or would be more problematic for us, and that is that in these homilies on the Gospels, we find Gregory articulating a theology of the Eucharist that is understandable in light of the devastation he sees around him, even perhaps a sense that the world as it was once known is fading away. Gregory didn't have a lot of hope. In fact, he didn't really have any hope that the world was going to be changed in a dramatic way, that empire would be restored. No one could foresee what would happen with the crowning of Charlemagne and the restoration of a sense of dignity and of meaning and of value that would be infused into the West as a result of that event. Gregory sees devastation, decline, and decay, and so his spirituality or theology is based on an awareness of this, an acceptance of the fact that there is a lot of fear and trembling around him, and that it is in the Eucharist that one finds, as it were, the answer to that. And he also articulates a very commonly held understanding of God as one who represents a kind of power of judgment over the world, and the Eucharist as a means by which this judgment can be, as it were, softened or to some extent placated. Now this seems very problematic and transactional to us, and indeed it is not a Eucharistic theology or spirituality that would or should be tolerated in our own day. But unless we acknowledge it, unless we're aware of it in Gregory's texts, and unless we're aware of how he influences the later tradition, its presence in medieval theology will seem to be very strange and aberrational. It isn't. It comes from the time, it comes from the context, and this represents Gregory's articulation of it for the people of God. He begins, as you can see, commenting on the text from Luke 14, what king going to join battle against another king does not first sit down, take counsel with what he can do, and if he realizes he can't succeed, send a delegation and ask for terms of peace. For Gregory, the Eucharist will be the terms of peace that we are offering up to God to avoid being destroyed. So a king is coming to do battle, he says, and he comments on this. Then if you drop down to the blue bar, and please read the text of the homily at your own leisure, but I've highlighted several points at the blue bar, Mass keeps the dangerous judge at bay. That's effectively what Gregory is saying. The one who will come as our judge judges outers and inner manners alike. He weighs deeds and thoughts equally. Dropping down to the next paragraph, what must we do when we perceive that we have no power to stand in the presence of this judge? We do not yet see him present for judgment, so we send him as our delegation, using the allegory of this biblical text. We send him our tears as delegation, our works of mercy and propitiatory victims on his altar, namely the Eucharist, the Eucharistic sacrifice. We cannot contend with him in judgment, so let us ask for terms of peace. So using the military language, the language of imminent destruction, which is so prominent in his culture, he tries to help people understand the usefulness, the significance, the beauty, and the value of the Eucharist. And then in a sort of surrounded and lighter text that is highlighted, the sacrifice of the altar pleads in a unique way for our forgiveness. For he who rising from the dead will never die again is even now suffering for us anew through this sacrifice. So Christ in the sacrifice is effecting our answer to this deep-seated dread within the human heart that everything is collapsing, everything is falling apart, everything is falling under the judgment of God. The Eucharist is the answer, it is the place to find peace. And now we find two very strange, I think one could call them rather weird stories, which are miracle stories intended to illustrate to the people of God that the Eucharist has this power. The first story, and read it on your own, we won't look at it in detail, a man is taken away as a slave and spends a long time in chains, and his wife, not knowing whether he's living or dead, offers stipended masses, that is to say, she arranges for masses to be said for him, and during the celebration of those masses, he realizes that his chains have somehow been miraculously loosened, so it's, as it were, the mass is loosening the chains in a physical way of this man, and he doesn't realize it until later, and that Gregory draws a kind of an allegorical moral from. Therefore, it has the power to loose the bonds of our hearts. Undoubtedly, this was a story well known and told in Gregory's day, we would today call it rather silly or even superstitious story. However, he's trying to give it a significance. He's trying to invest it with a meaning that allows people to understand the Eucharist as something that has the power to loosen a deeper kind of chain, a deeper kind of hold. The second and more common illustration is of a bishop who daily offers Mass, and there's a purple bar that introduces this second story, and who, as a result of his daily faithfulness to the celebration of the Eucharist, is ultimately rewarded with heaven. And if we drop down then to the very conclusion of this, there is a kind of sense in which we expiate sins both by renunciation and by the offering of masses, and this is done before what he calls the angry slayer arrives. The offering up of propitiatory sacrifices, asceticism on our own part, and of participating in and of arranging for masses to be said for various intentions is, as he puts it, the delegation made up of the daily sacrifice with almsgiving and tears. Let those who can abandon everything, that is, the religious who can vow poverty, do that, but one who cannot can send a delegation of tears and almsgiving and offer the gift of the sacrifice, that is to say, the Eucharistic sacrifice. We cannot bear the wrath of the judge. We want him to be appeased by our prayers, and we know how fearful he is. He whom we cannot endure because of his anger desires to be appeased by the delegation of peace he has begged for. So the holy celebration of the Eucharist is a kind of atoning for sins through the sacrifice of Christ himself. Here again, we can see this as the beginnings of a rather more problematic Eucharistic theology than we have seen in the earlier patristic tradition and with which we are more familiar and comfortable today. But again, it must be borne in mind that this is a response of Eucharistic theology to an era that sees the imminent collapse of the universe itself, and in which the Eucharist is seen as a fixed point of the constant presence of and love and mercy of God in the midst of this collapsing world. And against that background, I think we can perhaps afford to be a bit more generous of and understanding of this approach.